Thursday's Plain Fraser versus Kimball.
His claim to all levels of the Oklahoma State Courts and the District Court that he received ineffective assistance of counsel when his attorney did not provide him notice that there's a potential he could be serving a sentence double the maximum statutory penalty due to the age of the victim in the case. This is not a new claim that we just came up with. Here in this court, this was presented by Mr. Fraser inartfully, but by Mr. Fraser in his pro se filings, first to the Illinois Circuit Court, in his motion to supplement his post-conviction petition, number six. These are all in the short appendix. Then again on his motion for rehearing, pro se motion for rehearing to the Illinois Court of Appeals, and then finally in his petition for leave to appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court. What I want to make clear is this is a claim that he has consistently fairly presented to the state courts.
So where is the clearest signal to the Illinois courts that he's complaining about effectiveness of his counsel?
What you have, where we find it, is first in the initial Circuit Court, the motion to supplement post-conviction six. You have Mr. Fraser writing out first that he was not given prior notice of the possibility of an extended term had been provided by the state prior to sentencing, coupled with petitioner was never apprised or put on notice that he was charged under the extended term sentence. This, respectfully, Your Honor, is not the responsibility of the prosecution. That this is of the court. This is an attorney's core responsibility. You can look at it at the Lafleur case, where it states that attorney's responsibility is to let their client know, among other things, the potential outcomes if they choose to plead to a charge and make sure that they are fully aware of what may or may not happen, have all the information they need to knowingly, voluntarily enter into that plea. Again, this is not our point. Yes, sir.
But if I understand this correctly, the state courts are supposed to read the phrase, I'm looking at short appendix 23,
yes,
are supposed to read, this court must decide whether harmless error can be applied to a situation where no prior notice of the possibility of an extended term had been provided by the state prior to sentencing. And they're supposed to read that and realize that's really an ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
When you couple that with then short appendix page 25, which is part of the same memorandum, again, my answer is yes, you are. This is, again, not a trained lawyer writing this out. This is the responsibility of his post-conviction counsel to review these pleadings and realize, no, this is not well-drafted, but this is a real claim, a meritorious claim that needs to be raised. I'd also suggest in the district court, again, Mr. Fraser very clearly raises this claim, saying that, here we go, I just want to make sure I get the language corrected on it, that he was never informed, admonished, or placed on notice that the state or the court would be seeking to enhance the sentence. Again, it's not the responsibility necessarily of the judge at trial or the prosecutor to inform a defendant. It's a lawyer's job to inform the defendant that this is what he's facing.
He's supposed to be told to arraign him what he's facing?
He is supposed to be, but again, it is the responsibility of the assigned attorney. If he is not provided with that information, or if he is unaware of that information, or if he does not understand that, or to provide that to his client. And in this case, that did, Mr. Fraser alleges and alleges consistently that did not happen.
Can I ask you if we've got first a question about whether these filings were sufficient to put the state courts on notice? I understand you've addressed that.
Yes.
There's obviously another question that I know you want to get to about whether, in general, supplemental pro se filings should be sufficient. Let me just raise my concern with you about this.
Yes, sir.
When we look at the role of appellate lawyers, generally or in the context of claims that appellate lawyers have been ineffective, we and other courts have made clear repeatedly that part of the lawyer's job is to select issues, including to discard even potentially meritorious issues because there are other stronger issues to raise, right?
Yes.
My concern is that your position, and frankly the position adopted in our non-presidential Kaiser order, would seem to encourage a practice in which the lawyer picks a handful of the best potential issues, and then the client files a pro se supplement in the Illinois state courts with everything else, and with or without help from the lawyer. And under your approach, the state courts would then have to deal with all of those issues.
Those non-meritorious issues, yes, Your Honor. Those non-meritorious,
everything presented by the petitioner, by the defendant and his lawyer, at least if 2254D is going to come into play, right?
Your Honor, yes, as I understand your question, I want to make sure I do.
Okay.
Yes, the state courts would have to address whatever the counsel raised. And again, well, I'll move on in just a moment, as well as any pro se filings of issues are of merit that the pro se petitioner raises.
Well, under your theory, the state court would need to deal with any issues on the merits, even in hybrid supplemental pleadings or briefs that are stricken, right?
I don't believe I understand.
These were stricken. You are saying the state courts, in essence, were obliged to see an ineffective assistance of counsel claim hidden in these pro se supplemental filings, but that fairly presented the issue to them, and that was their opportunity to fix any potential constitutional error, right?
Absolutely.
So this seems to totally screw up the incentives for appellate practice in criminal cases in Illinois, where defendant and his lawyer have every incentive to simply flood the state appellate court with everything they can possibly dream of.
Except, respectfully, that's not all the practice in Illinois.
Not yet. But I'm asking about the incentives that would be created if we treat supplemental pro se filings, stricken or not, as sufficient to present fairly federal claims to the state courts.
And I would suggest one that is appropriate in Illinois, specifically under the Illinois system, that is necessary as the appointed counsel on post-conviction appeal, do nothing with these pro se filings. And we go through that in our reply brief, but this is what I want to get to in addressing this, Your Honor, is that's not the practice in Illinois. The general practice, at least in Cook County, which is the practice of what happened in Mr. Fraser's case specifically, is that an attorney is presented and then simply is supposed to review these pro se filings and, yes, develop them, and as you said, sift out the meritorious from non-meritorious issues. But that's not what happens. Instead, the attorney does nothing with the pro se pleadings, and then some years later informs the court that appointed the attorney to review and develop those pleadings. They're fine as is. Go ahead and rule on them. I have nothing to add. This is exactly what happened in Mr. Fraser's case and what seems to be what is the regular practice in the Illinois courts. So quite frankly, if I understand your question, not only would you not be flooded with filings from counsel plus supplemental pro se filings, you aren't now, or Illinois is not now. Illinois generally, not in every circumstance, but generally receives our pro se filings because the post conviction procedure is initiated by these pro se filings, and then the attorneys do nothing with them. They just stand on them. So I suggest this would at least allow those pro se petitioners who raise meritorious claims to prosecute them.
I think there's an additional problem here, waiver or forfeiture. There was not an ineffectiveness argument of the sort that you're making now raised in the district court. The sole ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim that was raised in the district court is one for failure to bring a motion to reduce his sentence, your client's sentence. And the claim you're raising now is that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to give your client notice of the extended sentence.
Respectfully, I disagree with that reading of what was filed in the district court.
Well, that's how the district court understood it.
And again, I would say the district court was wrong, with all due respect.
Can you identify language where you clearly framed this as a Strickland claim?
I'll read to you the language that I suggest does make this point out. Yes, it does not use the language of Strickland, I'll make that clear. But
it's an Apprendi claim.
No, it is not. Mr. Fraser wrote in his first round, in his habeas petition, it's a failure, the caption, failure to know by a sentence enhancement. He then says he was not appraised nor admonished of the facts. He does not say, my counsel did not appraise or admonish me of these facts. But that's
not enough to put the district court on notice that this is a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Respectfully,
it would be recognized as a claim that either the statute itself didn't give sufficient notice, perhaps, or that the court didn't give him notice, or that the indictment didn't give him notice. That's not remotely phrased as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
And this, again, goes to the issue of the pro se pleadings and how they should be read. This is a man who states over and over to the state courts and then to the district court, I was not given the information I needed to choose whether to go to trial or to plead that there's this extended sentence out there. And that is the responsibility of the trial attorney or the defendant.
Is there any evidence here in our record, counsel, that Mr. Fraser was ever willing to consider pleading guilty?
There is very little evidence one way or the other.
What has he submitted at this point?
Besides what we have in the pleadings themselves, which again are written by Mr. Fraser, signed by Mr. Fraser, and most of them are notarized, no, it's not an affidavit. But there, I do suggest you take that into consideration. You have this letter by his trial counsel that is in the record that is cited in the reply brief as well. To the IARDC, April 1998, stating, claiming that Mr. Frazier was never offered an 8-year sentence, and that he never wanted to pursue an offer. The inference that I suggest should be drawn from that is that some number of years was offered at some point, if not 8. And if, whether it was communicated to Mr. Frazier or not, this is what we need an evidentiary hearing for. This is why we are requesting an evidentiary hearing.
Well, here's my concern, counsel. And the premise of this ineffective assistance of counsel claim for prejudice is that he would have been prepared to plead guilty. In the district court, he is insisting on his factual innocence, correct?
That is correct. I would state in my own experience at trial, quite frankly, my clients often will, up until the moment of a plea, tell me how innocent they are. I would say that's not indicative of actual innocence or non-innocence, respectfully.
This is years after conviction. This is, we're in the federal habeas proceeding that is on appeal now, and he's insisting on factual innocence. At the same time, you're telling us he was prejudiced because he didn't get a chance to plead guilty on an informed basis. So why should we treat that as a substantial claim for purposes of Martinez and Trevino?
Because, quite frankly, when a defendant does not know, is not informed by the lawyer who's supposed to represent them going to trial, that he could face double the maximum sentence as opposed to the maximum sentence, that impacts the decision the defendant makes. And I refer the court to Julian B. Bartley and Moore B. Bryant that stand very much for that proposition.
I understand that in the abstract. I have a little trouble with a fellow who's still insisting he's factually innocent while also asserting this claim.
But we are not, up here before this court, we are not raising a claim of innocence at all. I won't make that clear. We're raising this one. But quite frankly, a defendant has a right, respectfully, to pursue multiple avenues of defense, Your Honor. Again, drawing from my own years of the trial practice, that I suggest that's not abnormal or inappropriate. I also, again, refer to Lafleur v. Cooper, which very clearly states that the criminal practice is majority a practice of pleas. 90%+, I believe, is what the Supreme Court cited in Lafleur, of the number of criminal cases that are resolved through a plea. I see my time is up. I just
think
there's nothing further.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, and may it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Eldon Malamuth here today on behalf of Appellee. As the discussion in the appellant's argument indicated, there are several roadblocks blocking him from success on this appeal. But the number one roadblock is that he didn't raise the claim that he now asserts before the district court. Thus, the claim is forfeited. Now he's arguing that his counsel was ineffective for advising him that he might be subject to an extended term sentence because his victim was over 60 years of age. And he asserts that he raised it in claim one of his habeas petition. But as the questions already indicated, claim one did no such thing. Instead, the claim one attacked was the sufficiency of the indictment. Quite clearly attacked the notice provided by the indictment. How do we know? Because it specifically cited the Illinois statutes indicating that what the requirements are of the charging instrument of the indictment. We also know that petitioner did not raise an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, because when he wanted to do so, he could. In claim four, he raises ineffective assistance of counsel. So he knows how to do so when he wants to. Claim one, he does something very different. So the claim was, the claim included no mention of counsel, the claim is forfeited. Very briefly, the claim is also defaulted. It was not raised in the state court. Now, I just want to briefly clear up one, what I think is sort of a factual question. The stricken pro se supplemental briefs. So counsel now is not asserting that the claim he raised was raised on direct appeal in the pro se supplemental briefs that were stricken. He raises some ineffective assistance of counsel claims there, but they were very different claims. The claim, the place in the, in where he claims, where he now says the clearest instance of him raising this claim was in one of his amendments to his post-conviction petition. This was never stricken by the court. So if indeed it did raise the claim, there's no issue of whether this, the pro se supplemental briefs on appeal, this court would not need to resolve whether those were somehow preserved issue. So the clearest instance he's pointing to is on one of the amendments to the post-conviction petition. And it again indicates just the notice of the charging instrument. Again, how do we know? On the page petition point, the page petition points to, it states the petitioner asserts that the charging instrument did not allege that the complainant was over the age of 60. And it goes on to say, and therefore there was no prior notice. So the claim there too was to the charging instrument. Finally, so
counsel, just so I got this straight, you're telling us we don't need to decide, in essence, the Kaiser issue about supplemental pro se pleadings.
That's right, Your Honor. In our briefs, we discussed why the state court did reject it on independent state ground. But here, this isn't where petitioner argues he's raising it. He's raising it on the post conviction petition, and one of the amendments to the post conviction petition. And that wasn't stricken. So he filed a whole bunch of amendments. The post-conviction petitioner, the counsel just went forward with those, the petition and the amendments. I don't believe that was ever. So the Kaiser issue has to be the pro se supplemental briefs on appeal that were, petitioner is not claiming that those were in there. There's a brief mention in one of them of the Apprendi claim. So I guess in theory, if any Apprendi claim were to preserve this claim, the court could reach that issue. But otherwise, there's no reason for the, it's not necessary for the court to reach that issue here. Finally, just with respect to the evidence, there is no evidence that petitioner ever considered pleading guilty. If anything, as discussed, there's only the negative assertion that there was no plea offer on the table. Indeed, this evidence was so negligible, I believe that we were the first to raise it, to note it on appeal. So there's no indication that petitioner ever considered pleading guilty. If this court has no further questions, we would ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court.
If we get to Martinez Trevino, should we decide that issue for the state of Illinois as a whole in this case?
Your Honor, this court certainly may decide it for Illinois as a whole, in that Illinois has procedures that allow criminal defendants to raise ineffective assistance of counsel claims post-trial, and then to develop the record as necessary post-trial, and then to proceed with those claims on appeal. So if there is a rule as applied to the state as a whole, then indeed Illinois would not fit under the narrow circumstance that Martinez and Trevino outlines. We know from Coleman the general rules that post-conviction counsel conduct cannot form the basis of cause for the cause and prejudice test. Then there is this narrow exception only when it was prohibited or virtually impossible for a petitioner, criminal defendant, to raise the claim. In Illinois, It is far from virtually impossible. There's a whole procedure known as the Krankel procedure, in which an initial inquiry and then for a colorable claim, a full-blown evidentiary hearing may take place. And of course, claims on based on the face of the record must be raised on direct appeal. So Illinois does not fit under the narrow exception outlined in Martinez.
I don't know if you heard the discussion in the last case out of Indiana about where the Attorney General referred to a situation in which trial counsel and appellate counsel are the same. Does that happen in Illinois?
It's possible it happens, Your Honor. The one thing I noticed, first of all, again, Illinois' rule allows for the appointment of separate counsel in these Krankel inquiries. It allows for the someone to retain counsel to hire new counsel post-trial. So all an Illinois criminal defendant who is appointed counsel has to do is raise a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, and there will be some sort of inquiry at the trial level as to that allegation. And so even in a circumstance in which trial and appellate counsel were the same, there would have been an opportunity to proceed with those claims had trial counsel had the criminal defendant simply voice that concern at post-trial. But again, needless to say, that's not the case here. So again, we would ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I'll give you a couple more minutes, 2 minutes.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Going to the issue of these Krankel hearings, I want to make clear that they are initiated by pro se filings. They are not initiated, at least in the case of an indigent defendant such as Mr. Fraser. They do not allow for going beyond as the facts that are on the record. They do not allow for expanding the record, unlike as I understand from that state the Wisconsin system does. Illinois state courts have said that the preference is for that very reason to bring these ineffective claims in collateral, post-conviction claims, not on direct appeal. A petitioner, a defendant, is not appointed counsel, an attorney for a criminal hearing until the court has determined there is a meritorious claim there for counsel to be appointed. If the petitioner doesn't know to raise the effectiveness of their counsel, that claim then is waived and they won't have an attorney appointed to represent them to develop that claim. And again, even if so, in a circumstance such as this, where it goes to communication between the lawyer and his client that are not on the trial record, that is not a claim that can or will be can be raised in such a hearing. So I suggest Krankel is not a fix or way around to avoid the issue of tribunal, respectfully. And I would just suggest, again, in Mr. Fraser's claim specifically, at every state fact development stage, he was acting pro se. He did not have counsel appointed to him until after the fact development stage. So although his pleadings are unartful, that's why he needed counsel to be appointed to him, why we are asking for an evidentiary hearing to go back now to essentially develop the record as to what was or was not communicated to him. I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.